who's I just met this weekend. I heard some things about her, some very good things from the committee members and from our West Virginia State delegate. After just a few conversations with her, I do believe that we are soulmates. We found we have many things in common. She can tell you about some of them. I would ask, I did find out that she has a voice problem and that smoking irritates it. And if we want to hear her complete talk, we would appreciate it if you don't smoke while she's talking. Thank you. With that, I will give you Peggy L. from Lansdowne, Pennsylvania.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It has been a marvelous weekend. And I just want to say that I appreciate your committee so much for asking me, for inviting me, for providing a lovely room and a little fruit basket to keep us going. And this setting is absolutely fabulous. And, you know, you just need to be with the gang of Al-Anon people for a few minutes and you're just one of the family, right? And that's the way I feel. But imagine how I felt when this lovely lady told me that her name was George. I was sure I was in the right place, mixed up. And as she and I got to talking, we discovered that we each are combined families. We're the moms in combined families. And George was just telling me that she's been married, it'll be 18 years? It is going on 18 years, and Jim and I are going on 14 years, and we have 14 children. And so it's been a busy 14 years, let me tell you. I brought 10 kids to this gang. I had 10 babies before my 31st birthday. Now that's people-pleasing. That's why I need this program. I got to get out of that. I'm here with my husband, Jim, who is not the father of the children. And he brought 4. He's kind of a piker. But I guess he was doing his best at the time. But and I might add, he's still doing his best. Oh, this is supposed to be a spiritual talk. Excuse me. You're right, that's pretty spiritual. I was surprised at knowing so many people here. Wow, it was really neat to see so many Pennsylvanians. especially our Alateen coordinator, our archivist, you know, all the kind of bigwigs around town. So it was really, really neat. And I've enjoyed the speakers so much. And in fact, last night I felt like saying, well, gosh, what do they need me for? And my husband said, well, you have to sing for your supper, so you better get up there anyway. So here I am, and I'll do my best. But we have had some marvelous speakers this weekend, I'll tell you. And those kids yesterday, they really, really were fabulous. And Dawn, she ought to go on the road, don't you think, as kind of a salesman for Al-Anon? You know, woo, 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 you know, fabulous. Thank you so much. Thank you. And, of course, Don and I are old friends. We met at the WSO. I've been serving at the WSO on in-town committees for several years. I had a friend who was commuting from Philadelphia, and she would tell me about all these things that she had to do. She had to go to this conference for a whole week. I said, a whole week? What are you kidding? Are you kidding? Up in New York, you have to, you know, sit around in a hotel and all. She said, oh, we're busy from morning till night at this conference. I said, it sounds terrible. And then she had to go over on Saturday mornings. She had to get up real early and get a train over to New York and be with all these Alateen kids and spend the morning with them and bat out some literature and do all this stuff. And, oh, I thought, that sounds awful. And so she said, yeah, it is. It's pretty tough. Why don't you come with me? So I did, and one day I received a letter in the mail that said, would you be willing to join the literature committee? And I said, okay, I would try it. And, of course, my mother knew about how to fit. My cousin had just been mugged in New York the week before, and she was just beside herself. Don't get on that train. Don't go to New York. Don't dare. Don't. And but, you know, I always didn't do what she said, and and I wasn't about to change. So I got on the train and took myself up there. And after about a year of being a committee member, I became chairman of the literature committee and held that service position for 2 years and went to a couple of conferences. And Jackie was on our literature committee at the time, and we argued and carried on and did our best with our literature. And while I'm talking about literature, I wanted to say that whenever I have gone around as the literature committee chairman, the main question that's always been asked is, why does it take so long to get a piece of literature through the literature committee? Why can't we have our literature? Adult children need literature. We need literature on sexual matters and sexual problems. And and we need so much literature. So but what I like to say is that it's because we're not commercial. You know, we're not writing for a market to sell an idea. We are writing recovery literature that has to come from your recovery. So we can't send you a recovery piece about how you've used the program to recover and you're an adult child or whatever your problem is. Whatever your situation is as you perceive it, we can't send a piece out unless you send us how you've recovered. How have you used let go and let God? How have you used being powerless in terms of being an adult child? How have you used this material? And write it to us. And that's the way we get our recovery pieces. And what I like to say is that it takes a while to become sick. Then it takes a while to realize that you are sick. Then it takes a while to decide to do something about it. Then it takes a while to realize that you're using a program after you've decided to do something about it. And then it takes a while to write about it, to be well enough to write something. And then it takes a while to get around to writing to the WSO. And then we have a recovery story to send to the WSO. But I want you to remember that recovery material can't be written unless you write it, unless you send it. So I'll be looking for things from you. I've served for the last 3 years as chairman of the Alateen In-Town Committee. And I've had the privilege over those few years of being with a few thousand recovering kids who are using our program to recover and to neutralize the effects of alcoholism on them as they grew up. And it was an absolutely impressive experience to be at these weekends with the kids. We were at one in Southern California where there were a good thousand kids there, and we did absolutely nothing. The adults did nothing. I've gone to these where you know, where I get signed up for duty at 3 to 4 in the morning, where you have to patrol the halls and pull them out of the bushes and all. And I'm good at that, though. And but at the Southern California, we didn't have anything to do. The sponsors all sat on the lawn and ate their, you know, Fritos and just had a great old time because the kids took care of everything. And as we sat, as the kids would be reading their 12 steps and their traditions to open their meeting, the audience would be sitting and saying by heart, by rote, every word of the steps and the traditions, saying it out loud with the you know, the leader of the pack here. And we've had many impressive experiences traveling around being with the Alateen kids. It works. It works. It works. It works. And you know what? Every place we go, we say, they say, and the letters that come into the office say, well, we, you know, there's such a lack of sponsors. We can't get sponsors. Well, it's not an easy job. John and I had a little talk about this yesterday. He loves his job being an Alateen sponsor, and I loved it too. But I found it draining, and I found it difficult. And the most real heartrending part of my part as a sponsor. I was a sponsor in at our meeting, at Drexel Hill meeting, for 5 years. And every Wednesday for those 5 years, I had to walk past my beloved home meeting and had to walk into that room with the kids. I loved it, and I got a lot out of it, and I grew, and I was able to relate to my kids so much better with having, you know, an insight into their experience. But it hurt. There was that pang every time I walked by and saw my dearest, loved, most wonderful friends in all the world sitting in that meeting, and I walked by and went to the Alateen meeting. It hurt. So this year at our Alateen World Service Conference presentation, we talked a lot about the younger members of Alateen and how we need to work with them and provide some material for them. There's a very, very large percent, more than half, of what of Alateen members are under 12 these days. I didn't know if you knew that. And so we need to provide material. We need to provide loving sponsors who are willing to walk into a room with the young kids. So we talked about how, you know, this is the year of the sponsor, how to sponsor a sponsor. All of us can't be Alateen sponsors. I agree, and I understand, and I know why not. I know what you're saying. But we can be nice to a sponsor. We can sponsor a sponsor. You know, a person walks out of that room, and their heart is heavy, and they can't say anything that's happened. They cannot talk that over with anyone unless they've had unless they have a co-sponsor that they can talk things over with. So, just kindness, just being really kind and really loving toward a sponsor and giving them emotional support with the burden that they have to carry. And it is a burden. Besides being 5 years at our regular meeting, I was also 5 years as a sponsor at an all-girls Catholic high school in my neighborhood. And the first year, three semesters, the end of 1 year and the full year the following year, five of the dads died. And they were ages 37 to 45. Now that was a burden for me. I mean, it was public knowledge that there were the deaths. But the girl that was incestually treated by her dad and had a nervous breakdown, that was not, you know, was not something that I could talk about. I could only sit and bear that pain with that little girl. So what I'm saying is sponsors need to be loved. They need to be nurtured. They need care. They need support. One of the things that we talked about was take a sponsor out to lunch. Call them up and just, you know, say, we're thinking of you. You can't ask them any questions, and I respect that, and I don't want you to do that, but just say, we're thinking about you. We care about you. You can ask them if they need anything in that room. There might be things that they need. They might need some material that the kids can't afford to buy. So we're supposed to be self-supporting. My God, you don't have to, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's everywhere. You can slip them a piece of literature. You can hand them a bag of pretzels or a bag of chips or something like that for the kids to sit and munch on. So what? They get a little mad if they don't clean up. Walk in the room and put the bag away. Throw it in the trash. Make sure the kids have cleaned up. There are just so many things, and I don't want to get my scolding tone, but I do hear it. But I'm just saying, you know, if we love each other and we support each other, we have found the areas that there is a good relationship between Al-Anon and Alateen sponsors. We have no trouble getting sponsors, and the Alateen kids thrive. So that's the end of my plug for that. But you can see that it's a real soft spot in my heart. And as I say, in the areas where there's a spiritual closeness between Al-Anon and Alateen, everybody thrives. Al-Anon thrives too. I'm currently, just for the last few months, been serving on the forum committee. And so I'm just a regular old member. I'm not a chairperson. I don't have to get a meeting ready. I don't have to do anything. I just get on the train and go on over and bring my homework, and it's fabulous. But I'm starting to learn a lot about the forum. You know, I sit and read it and enjoy it and have for many years, and have given subscriptions to friends in the program as gifts and all. But I'm seeing that so many things go into it. And one of the things that I was surprised to find out was that everything that is sent to the forum is typed up and looked at. And things come into the forum on little green pieces of paper this big. Some come on yellow-lined paper. Some come typed up with headings. So all of those things are put into a pile, and the secretary types everything up. And then a couple of people at the office look at the material, and they see what might be pertaining, maybe to the office or to another area of the office. Maybe something is more particular to PI or to CPC, then it's sent to that area. If something is not, really pertaining to what we would put in the forum, then they look it over and then they write a note to the person usually and say, would you like to change it, or would you like to do this or do that? And then they put it through the process. They put it in manuscript form, and the committee looks through it, and we go over it, and then we decide what will go into the issues. Nothing is thrown away. Everything is looked at, as I say, typed up, and something is done with it. So we're asking that you do send your material, send your stories, send your funny things. We'd like to know for our presentation at the World Service Conference next year about how are the many ways that you've used the forum. Do you use the roundtable topics? What do you like in the forum? What do you not like? We'd like to hear that too. So please let us hear from you. I've been praying about something over the last couple of days, and I think I'm going to try it. It's the way I'd like to start my talk today, my real talk. That was just my little plugs for things. I love you. Wait a minute. I love you, Lord. And lift my voice to worship you, O my soul, rejoice. Take joy, my King, in what you hear. Let it be a sweet, sweet sound in your ear. I'm the oldest. Thank you. I'm the oldest of a large Irish Catholic family. And in our family, we drank when you were born. We drank when you died. We drank when you lost your job. And we drank when you found it again. Alcohol runs in some families, but it gallops in mine. As a little Catholic high school girl and school girl, a higher power was always a part of my life. And I prayed, and I turned things over, and I did what I thought a person's supposed to be. Was supposed to do, and as I told you, I was a good little Catholic. I had those 10 babies, and I had 8 girls and 2 boys, and I'll tell you about them further as we get along. But my parents lived 80 miles away from my home, but I was very, very much involved with what was going on in their home, even though I had my kids. And I ran my home like a little army camp, and I was the general. I was still trying to be very much in charge of their situation. My dad had a drinking problem, which we kept under the table, and we didn't bother much about it. But when my brother was killed in Vietnam, everything escalated. The whole family took it really, really hard, and it's actually something that it happened in 1968, and we're still not over it. About 6 weeks after my brother was killed, my younger brother, who was a teenager at home, I had two teenagers at home, a brother who was a senior in high school and a sister who was in 10th grade. And my brother called up and he said, I was up in the counseling office today, filling out papers to go away to college, and he said, and there's no way I can leave Mom and Teresa with Dad. Over the weekend, we had the police. There was all this pushing around. Dad was drunk. He doesn't remember anything that happened, and we've got to do something. We've got to get Daddy to stop drinking. And, of course, since I was the oldest, I was in charge of getting Daddy to stop drinking. And so we set up a family meeting. It was for the next night, and everybody arrived at my house, and they all arrived with their six-packs. And found the dining room table trying to decide how to get Daddy to stop drinking. And when the six-packs were done, then they would go out the back door to the friendly tavern, which was 38 steps from my back door, but who counts? And they would get another six-pack, and then they would come back and sit around, and we'd finish that off. They'd finish that off. So finally, we got around to calling AA. And the person on the other end of the AA line listened for 45 minutes while the phone got passed around the dining room table. Well, he did this and he said that and he curses now, and he never cursed before. And, you know, our dad sang in the choir. He took up the collection. He went through the neighborhood collecting the church debt for the new buildings. And we were a fine, upstanding, wonderful family. So how could this horrible thing happen? We just were at a complete loss. And the time was getting on, and I guess they couldn't afford too many more six-packs, so they decided that we better work out a solution for how to get Daddy to stop drinking. And the man on the phone said, well, I really don't, we don't really come and visit people. You need to come to the meeting. So we didn't know what he was talking about, but they would have somebody call back. So the person called back and told my brother that there was a meeting right in our neighborhood a few blocks away the next night. And so, of course, I, being the only non-drinking member of the Martin family, was elected to go to the meeting. And I didn't want to be there with all the drunks because that disgusted me. But I figured if they had some information, I would go get it, and then I would tell them, and they could pass it on to Dad. So when I walked into the Al-Anon, to the church, I walked in. Here was a couple of these big coffee pots. And there were these guys standing around drinking the coffee. So I went over and I said to this man, could you tell me something? How did you guys start to drink coffee? And the man turned to me and he said, the Al-Anon meeting is upstairs. So I dutifully went upstairs and saw all these chairs set up. And I stayed by the door, and this lady came along, and I said, what's this with the meeting? And she said, oh, well, you go in and you sit down. There's seats up front. Go and sit down. I said, well, how long does this last? And she said, well, about an hour. I said, oh, well, I can. I have 10 homeworks. She said, you need a front seat. She took me up front. Would you believe my higher power was working before I got there? Well, you all know that, don't you? Do you know that the two speakers were two high school kids the same age as my brother and sister at home? And they were telling how they were using this Al-Anon program to live a life. They were using Alateen. And they were planning. They had an active alcoholic mom, active alcoholic dad, and an active alcoholic grandma. They were planning a six-week trip to California with the alcoholic grandmother. Now, I don't know what I thought you did with alcoholics, but start with flush them down the toilet. You never would get on a plane with an alcoholic. I thought if you told a person they were an alcoholic and that it was making them sick and ruining the family and they were spending too much money and all that, I thought that they just stopped drinking. And so I couldn't imagine now that you've got to cope and you've got to learn how to do things. And, well, anyway, these kids went on at a great rate and were telling some really fabulous success story. The girl had just won a scholarship to a very highly thought of academic school in the area, a college, and the young boy, he was just planning this and that and the other, and I couldn't believe it. I would think that if you were alcoholic, you just laid down, you know, if you were from that kind of a family, you just laid down and died, or you waited for them to wise up. I just couldn't imagine. It was unfathomable. But as they spoke and as people shared, I began to realize that I had a bittersweet feeling. I had this feeling that wouldn't it be great if I could let go of this burden that was around my neck? Wouldn't that be great? But on the other hand, if Peggy didn't do something about it, then who would? So it was a bittersweet thing that I walked out with that night. And the lady on the way out was one of those Al-Anon people that are outspoken. You've heard of those. And she said, you know, your dad's the drinker. I said, yeah. And she said, well, you know, it's not your ass. And I said, I'm looking all around. How vulgar. And she said, you're not the one with the drinking problem. She said, you got 10 kids? I said, yes. And she said, well, get home and take care of them. You know, let your father, let him drink himself into it. Let him do what he wants to do. Good advice, right? But boy, if I didn't do it, who would? You know, and I had to go home with that. And maybe I'd come back and look things over. So I thought it over the few days, and I decided, well, the best bet then would be for me to become an expert on this disease. And then I would find out everything about it, and then I would, you know, get it all organized, and the whole family would stop drinking, and we'd all be happy. So I found out, you know, in the newspaper, all these workshops about alcoholism, and I went to them, and for about 6 weeks, I really kept my nose in a book, every book I could find, talked to every expert that I could get on the phone, went to every kind of teaching kind of thing. Not too many meetings, of course, because they were kind of sappy. You know, those people were saying all this stuff about let go and let God and live and let live and live your own life and you're powerless. It all sounded kind of dumb. I thought that they really needed information and I would kind of be in charge of that. So in about 6 weeks, I was an expert and found out that the father of my 10 children definitely had a drinking problem. And so one day I went home one of these information things, and after this man had spoken about this, given us all this good information, I went up to him and I said, you know, I think that this is the strangest thing. I came here because of my dad's drinking, but I think that the father of my children has a drinking problem. He said, oh, yeah? And I said, yes. And he said, well, what makes you say that? I said, well, gosh, I'm not allowed to have any money, but he has money, and we always have the beer man, always delivers the beer. He's out every day after work. Everything I do is wrong. I don't clean enough. I don't cook enough. I don't take care enough. And he said, sounds like there's a little problem. And I said, yes, and I'm starting to really hate him. And he said, well, do you think he'd want to talk to me about his drinking? I said, oh, sure. He'll be right over because, you know, he doesn't want this any more than I do. I mean, he wants happiness and health and, you know, prosperity and wonderful things and all the things that I dreamed of and read about in Family Circle magazine. So he wanted all that, and he said, well, then you have him call me and he can make an appointment and we'll talk things over. So, oh, I said, this is no problem. Drove home and I pulled in the driveway and hopped out of the car and ran out of the house, and I said, oh, come on down here. I want to talk to you. Yes. Well, I just found out what the problem is. Oh, yes. Yeah, you're an alcoholic. Where are the car keys? I said, well, they're right here. You are never to go to that place again. So I wasn't allowed out, wasn't allowed to go. And so I didn't, but I did other things. Once in a while, I would get to a meeting, you know, and I would tell him it was a social thing and make very little out of it. I got the message. But I decided that there was something the matter with our marriage. It probably wasn't drinking because he said it wasn't. So I went to a marriage course, and I went alone. And the person who was running it, I would really lace him up and down at the end of each session, because he had these couples there, and I thought they were all plants. because they were trying to struggle and work on a marriage. And now that didn't make a bit of sense to me. I thought, you know, I would get this information, I would take it home and work. But these were like nice people. They were holding hands, they were talking nicely to each other. There was something wrong with them. And so finally the guy that was running it was very patient with me over the 6 weeks. And at the end he did say, you know, you gave us a lot of laughs here. He said, did you ever... I didn't know I was being funny. He said, did you ever look into being a stand-up comic? So much for being taken seriously. So I didn't sign up with him again. I decided to sign up for a yoga course. I thought that if I stood on my head long enough, they'd all stop drinking. And I guess that's what I thought. And I went to yoga, and it did help. I felt a lot better when they all drank. And I did get a lot out of that. And then the third session, I took a psychology course. Around me, I'll know what's going on, and I'll be able to do something about this drinking and remind them of what a poor job they're doing with their families and all this. Because in the meantime, while this was all going on, of course I recognized all the alcoholics around me. Even the cashier at the supermarket, she kept dropping things, and I knew that she needed either AA or Al-Anon because of having become an expert. I could just kind of smell them out, you know. And this psychology course would really help. And so I got there, and of course we had charts, and who ate their peas, and who did their chores. And so I had my charts, and I was perfect at this, because I could be like a little FBI agent. If, you know, I could zero in and find out who didn't eat what, and who didn't do their chores, and who didn't. In fact, Jim, my husband who's with me, he said last week when I asked him about something, I picked a piece of underwear up off the floor, and I said something about it. Did you wear this, or is this for the laundry? He said, you know, I'm going to get you a job with the FBI. Well, that you know, came naturally, being the oldest and the mother of a little army. And so anyway, I really did a great job with all my charts and with all my things. And I had perfect homework all the time. So as the end of the course came, I didn't tell you about my teacher. When I walked into the first class, he was sitting like a Buddha in the middle of a desk. And we sat all around him and listened and took our psychology course. And he was a very unusual, not at all like anything that I had ever met before, and very, very interesting person. Of course, everybody was interesting. You know, I was like a sponge at this point. And so one night we were having our break, and it was toward the end of the course, and he said, Peggy, you know, I'm opening up an office in the city. Oh, in the city. Wow. You know. And he said, and I'll need people to work in the office. Oh. And he said, yes, what I'll be working with is, it would be men, and they are sexually dysfunctional, and we would need for you to be a sexual surrogate. Now, eat your heart out. You would love the job. Admit it. So I took a sip of my Sprite, and I said, that is very, very nice of you, Leonard, but I really have too much ironing. I am telling you the truth. So anyway, while I was getting all this information and doing so well, the family disease of alcoholism was progressing. And my oldest daughter, who was a blooming, gorgeous, voluptuous 17-year-old senior in high school, her problems with drug and alcohol began to surface. She had been having these problems since she was in ninth grade. But I was so busy running my parents' home and running other people's lives and running a little marriage counseling service from my kitchen telephone. You know, if somebody would call up and say that their husband did this or that, I'd say, get a divorce. I would never stick around with somebody like that. And then if they would tell me about their kids misbehaving, mine never did, you understand, and I would say, well, my God, they better go to reform school. Now, where is Reform School? I mean, I don't know of it. I don't think we know of a Reform School. We have these places that kids can go, but I always said Reform School. That's what everybody said to me, you know. So anyway, they're the kinds of things that I was doing from my kitchen telephone and thinking that everything was okay with me. So you can imagine when my daughter disappeared and we found her in what would at that time, this was in 70, it would have been what we would have today as a crack house. At that time it was like a pot house or a sniffing place, that kind of thing. They're the kinds of things that she was into. Totally, totally shocked. And there was nothing to do but hospitalize her. And at that time, we didn't have what, you know, these rehab places that are like a ski lodge, and you drive up and they have 17 wonderful meals and all kinds of fruit around and gorgeous rugs and nice rooms, and they match you up with a roommate and all that. Uh-uh. This was a mental institution. Locked wards, locked elevator, locked everything. The only thing that wasn't locked away were those little pills. The first day she was given ground privileges, she went out with a baggie with purple pills, yellow pills, green, and all kinds of little things to pop and to take whenever she felt this or felt that or felt the other. And of course I was very, very ignorant of anything that was going on with her and heartbroken. On my way home from taking her to this, from admitting her to the mental institution, of course her father was on a business trip and I was alone. I was with my pediatrician, imagine, and myself, and we took her. And on the way home, I think that I realized the first thing that I had about detachment. You know, over the 3 years previous to this, since 1968, I had been a drop-in at Al-Anon meetings. I can't say I was a drop-out because I wasn't there enough. But I would drop in, as I said before, when there would be, I'd meet somebody in the supermarket and they'd say, we're going to have a good speaker, we're doing this, we're doing that, and I'd drop in. Those things that I heard at those meetings stuck. Isn't God good? Because they were here in my head as I was driving home in blinding sun, blinded by tears and sun. I heard God say, do what you can. You know, you can't do anything. Turn that over. Turn her over to the state. Turn her over. You've got to go home. There were 9 other kids at home. The oldest of those 9, the second oldest, was Janet, and she was cooking dinner for the rest of the kids. She had them all around the dining room table doing their homework when I walked in the door. So I knew something about detachment. I began to know. I stopped at a place on the way home that was a drug place. You know how to, you know, they had one of these trailers on the street and in a mall parking lot, and you could go in and ask questions. And I went in and told them about her, and they said, when she gets out of there, throw her out of the house. I thought that was harsh, but they were telling me something about detachment too, weren't they? And I didn't have to worry about throwing her out. Within a few weeks after she came home from the mental institution, she wasn't there too long, we were at a funeral, and when we came back, she had packed up and left. And I'd like to tell you that she hit the road, but for 10 years, she hit the street. And it was 10 rough, terrible, horrible years. But every time I would... So guess what? I went to Al-Anon, crawled in, and I knew that I was coming then for Peggy. I had come to the end of that old Peggy, the beginning of the end of it, and the beginning of God was happening in my life. I knew I was going to get help. I knew that people would care about me. I knew they would tell me what to do. I knew they would have a way for me, and they had everything for me to read, and they helped. They supported me. They cared about me. They hugged me. And for 3 weeks, I sat in the back of that room and cried. And I don't cry nice. I don't cry frequently. But when I do, it cries from the toes. So I sat in the back of those rooms, making lots of crying, loud, disruptive noises. And the meeting went on. And I grew. And they loved me. And they cared about me. And they probably did mind, but they didn't act like it. When I got hooked into Al-Anon, things began to change for me, and I began to change and get involved. And I knew that God God had a plan for Margie. I didn't know what it was. And I wish it would have been quicker, but it was, I knew, in his time. And whenever I would speak or share at a meeting or be involved with things, I would ask people to pray. And I asked everyone that I spoke to or whenever I spoke, please pray for Margie. Please pray that things will happen, that God will come into her life. And you know what? After many, many years, the call came. I hadn't seen her for 2 years. I hadn't talked to her for several months. And one night I was sitting with the other children and watching TV, and the phone rang. And I said to my son, you know, we were having a great time, and I said, if that's for me, ask them if I can call them back. And he talked for a minute, and he said, Mom, it's Marge. Do you want to talk to her? And I said, sure. So I went to the phone, and I said, hi, hon, how are you? And she said, well, I'm not as good as I'm going to be, but I'm a lot better than I used to be. And I almost fell over. And I said, well, where are you? She never would tell me where she was. And she told me where she was, and she said that she was going to meetings, but would I send her two books, a big book and a Bible? And I said, well, yes, but did you think about that you might like to come home? We have some great AA meetings here. And she said, Mom, would you want me? Would you want me home? I said, hon, I want you more than anything else in this world. And she said, okay. But I had been in Al-Anon long enough that I didn't say to her, well, here's my Visa number. She didn't have any money to speak of, but she was going to get a flight home. And you know what I had heard at the meetings? Well, they can always find money for booze, hon. If they want to fly home, they'll find the money. And all those things went through my head. But I want you to know that my palm sweats today at the thought of letting go of that telephone. It was like my hand was burned onto that phone, but I had to hang it up. I had to do it. I knew I had to do it. And I did it. And when I hung up, I screamed and I ran all through the house. You know those balloons that people, like you blow up the balloon and then you let it fly all around? Well, that's the way I was. Flying all around the house. My God, I can't believe it. And the kids are all running after me. What happened? What did she say? What do you mean? What's the matter? So then I dialed this number. It was my friend, my pastor's wife, and I said, kill the fatted calf. And she said, who is this? Then I kept calling people. We're having a party. And then I'd hang up. Well, for days, people didn't know who was this wild person that called them. And finally, about 2 hours later, a phone call came through, and it's Margie. And she said, Mom, I've been trying for 2 hours to call you. What's the matter? I said, well, I had to call everybody. She said, well, how did you know I was coming? I said, I don't know. I just know. And she said, well, she went to where she worked to tell the people she was leaving. And as she walked in the door, her boss came over to her and said, you know, I just realized that I owe you, all of you girls, an extra week's pay. Handed her this money, cash, not a check. Then this other girl came over to her and said, you know, I borrowed money from you a couple of weeks ago. Well, I have it tonight since he gave me that extra pay, so here's the money. She had exactly what she needed and a ride, which was a couple hours. She bumped into a guy who was doing something for the restaurant that she worked to, and he had to make a run to the area near the airport, which was 2 hours away, and he'd be glad to take her. He took her to the airport. She called me from the airport to tell me they were fogged in, and she said, I have like $2.95 or $2.45 after she paid her plane fare. And I said, well, honey bunch, you need to go to the bookstore when it opens. Of course, this is in the middle of the night. And find a book that tells you about the 12 steps and about how to, you know, how to live a new life. When she went to the bookstore, when it opened up, she was parked outside it. There was only one book that she could afford in that place. You know how books are, $5 and $10 and $15, even these little books. The only one she could afford was $2.45. And it was a book about how a man is using the 12 steps to live a spiritual life. And that's what she had to read. What she was calling to tell me was that she was fogged in and the planes would be late. And So I was at, so then I went to the Philadelphia airport, and she couldn't, she could finally get out of there, but she couldn't land in Philadelphia because the fog had hit. So here are all these planes flying around, and here is this mom walking up and down the Philadelphia airport, which, thank God, they're used to loony people there. Walking up and down saying, God, I can't do it. Oh, my God, I'll kill her.
I'll kill her. She better be all right. I got her.
Then I'd get all the way down the airport, and then I'd turn around and walk back and say, I can do it. You'll help me, and we'll be all right together, and there's nothing I can do. And then I'd scream and holler and stamp. But, my God, what if the other kids get like this? Oh, my God, I can't stand it. You know I can't. And all of this. And that's how I walked up and down the whole thing. And I couldn't control myself. It was there, you know, and it had to be said. I was all by myself, and I wasn't arrested. And finally, the plane landed. And I didn't know if I would recognize her, because she had come home over the years once in a while, dressed in very strange clothes, going through all kinds of strange phases, which I won't go into now. I've only been given an hour. And all kinds of weird things, and I didn't know what would get off the plane. But there, I stood and waited, and I didn't even know if I would recognize her. And as I say, I hadn't seen her in almost 2 years. And as they were all coming off, and the planes were crowded because of the fogging in situation, all of a sudden I hear this voice that says, "Hi, Mom." And I realized that I hadn't heard that voice since that kid was in about fifth grade. It was an entirely different person that came off that plane and got into the car. When I turned the key on of the car, she said, "You know, Mom, all the times that I screamed and hollered and cursed in that kitchen, when that radio station, which was a spiritual station, when that would go on, and you'd sing those songs, and you'd be so happy at what those people were saying, and I would scream and curse and stamp and rant and she said, I'm sorry for that. I know I have to begin now to make amends. And I want you to know that I'm sorry. But I also want you to know that all summer, the words that those people said and the words of those songs have just gone through my head to such a point that it almost drove me crazy." She said, "Something was after me, and something had a hold of me for all those years. And the something that was after me got me. And I'm so thankful." And I feel today that it was all those prayers and all those people that whenever they would think of it, they would send one up for Margie and for Peggy. And I just feel that God really worked. He moved into that situation, and I'm eternally grateful to him. Today, Margie has a combination prison ministry and a thing where she goes into a prison, a women's prison, takes the Bible and takes the big book, her two favorite things, and talks things over with these girls. And she works with them when they come out in the halfway house, and she's leading a very productive life. My only problem with Margie is she'll be 39 next month, and she has no husband. So now, that's what your commission is today. You guys have to start praying. Because I'll be very happy if she gets a husband. So I've learned so many wonderful things in Al-Anon. And, you know, when I brought Margie to the mental institution, that was the first worst day of my life. And I did never dream that I would have any worse days. But isn't God good? He keeps us growing, and he keeps us relying on him. And so many things have happened to me. As I told you before, I've met so many wonderful people, and I've been able to travel and do things for Al-Anon, my favorite, most favorite thing besides my husband and kids. And I've been able to share myself and tell people about how they can use the program and how God helps and intervenes and moves in when we need him. 2 years ago, on May 23rd, I received a phone call. I have a daughter named Renee, and she was married to a Marine, and they lived in San Diego. And he was the drug and alcohol officer. Steve was his name. He was the drug and alcohol officer on the base in San Diego. And the call came at 6 o'clock in the morning that Steve had been killed by a drunk driver on the way home from the base. Isn't that the irony of it all? It was their baby's second birthday. And it was a Saturday. And on Friday, they had been to the picnic at the base. And they had been flying a kite on the beach and having a great old time. And Steve and Colin, his little boy, they were the light of each other's life. And the following Friday, my Renee was back in the top bunk in her old bed with a crib beside her and her little baby in it, having gone through two funerals. And that happened, and we got all that over with. And the following Tuesday was the international, beginning of the international. And I had duties at the international in Seattle. So I had to get on a plane. And, of course, our family is very close and very comforting to each other. So she was surrounded with her sisters and her nieces and nephews and his family, and they all rallied around so I could leave. And I went to the international, and I did my duties, and I met some wonderful people. And, in fact, I even remember meeting people there, even though I was probably in a terrible fog. But isn't God good that he gave me all these things that I had to do, that I had to complete, and I couldn't back off or back out, and there wasn't any reason to. Renee was in good hands. And we had also planned that after the international that we would take the cruise up through Alaska, since we were on that side of the country, and God is so good and has provided for us to be able to do things once in a while like that. And when I got on the ship, I saw all the great things that they offer, and one of them was a massage. I'd never done anything like that before. How sexual. And and I thought, well, I'll try it, you know. I went to the Freedom Workshop this weekend, and I can write down a lot of things that Al-Anon has given to me in terms of freedom. And one of the things that I decided to do was to sign up for the massage. And when my appointment time came, I was scared because I didn't know what this was all about or what was going to happen. So I went up, and there was this very sturdy lady ready to give me my massage. And so I got down on the table and did what I was told, of course, and she said, my God, what's the matter with your arms? They're like iron. And then she's working on my back. My goodness, what's the matter with your back? And I said, oh, well, I did have surgery years ago. She said, I don't mean that. Your back, there's something wrong. It's all knots. How about your legs? Oh, my God, how are you working on these things? She said, what's the matter with you, girl? And I said, well, I've just been through a horrendous happening. I've flown across the country twice in the last 2 weeks and been through a couple of funerals. And I said, you know, my son-in-law was killed and my daughter's 28 and she's a widow and my grandson doesn't have a dad. I wasn't like crying, but the tears were dripping off this table onto the floor. And she said, she's slapping away, you know. And she said, well, Mom, there's nothing you can do about this one. And there was a sound after she said that it was a wail from my toes, a wail, a sound I've never heard, but it was the sound of Peggy letting go. And I wailed and I screamed and cried through that whole 45 minutes. And I learned something about letting go. And I don't know if this was a program person or not, but she knew what to say, didn't she? There's nothing, you can't change this one, Mom. And that's the way it was. And that's the way it is today. Can't change anything about Renee's life. She's doing okay, and so is Colin. They came and stayed with us for several months. And we were able to love and nurture and carry her around on a satin pillow for a while. I didn't forget all about that stuff. I still know how to do that. And I can pull it out of my bag of tricks when I need to. The problem with me was that I did it all the time. I was compulsive about carrying people around on a satin pillow. Now I know when it's needed and when I have to put that satin pillow away. So I feel that God has been very good to me. Over the last several years, I've also had other problems that I've had to apply the Al-Anon, Let Go and Let God with. About 5 years ago, I knew that I had to make Let Go and Let God my New Year's resolution. And I do every year. That's my New Year's resolution. I'm going to let go and let God this year. And that coincided with a phone call that I received from my son Keith, who lives in San Francisco in the gay community. He called me 5 years ago, and about 2 weeks, it'll be 5 years, to tell me that he had full-blown AIDS. He was very sick with pneumocystis and in the hospital. And so over those 5 years, I've had to do a lot of let-going and let-godding, because I didn't know anything about this disease. I really don't know anything about gay people. I didn't at the time. And I wasn't willing to get educated about any of that either. I didn't embrace it like I kind of embraced alcoholism. I'll become an expert in 6 weeks. 5 years later, I still resist. So I need a lot of prayer for that. But at this point, Keith is pretty sick. And in the last few weeks, there were even times that I thought, well, I'll just go on out to California and stay there and be with him, and that'll be that. He's just in a bad way. As you can imagine, when you come up to 5 years of a diagnosis like this, there's not much that can be done. And I might have to go next week, and I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But I do know that when I get to San Francisco, and if I have to stay, all I have to do is make a phone call. I can call my Al-Anon people, my Al-Anon friends, my Al-Anon family there. There are great meetings and great people out there. And I'll be okay. Whether I have to stay, whether I have to go through all the legal things that you go through with a death, or whatever God has for me, I can turn it over. I know God is in charge. He's in charge of every illness, whether it's alcoholism, from alcoholism to AIDS, he's in charge. And I'm with God. I can just rest in God. I rest my son in the palm of his hands. And that's how I pray for my son. I visually pray. I can't pray things away. I can't pray choices away. I can't pray happenings away, illnesses. But I can visualize my son in the palm of his hand, and that's what I do. I guess there's no way that I can express other than to just share with you what I've just shared, how this program has helped me to live and to live a great life. We have a ball together with all of our hurts and all of our ups and downs. We have become a close, loving, caring family. And I thank this program for that. And I thank the people that I've met. And I, it's so strange when I get here. When I got here, I saw so many people that you look exactly like in my meetings and in my area. You say exactly the same things. You're fun. You cheer each other up. You're helpful. You're just absolutely, absolutely fabulous. And I love you all, and I love having had a chance to share. I'd like to, as I leave, I'd like to share something from a pamphlet called Anne's Story. And it's one of Anne's favorite poems. And it kind of talks about what happened to me. One spoke a kindly word today when my need was sore. He had no way of knowing quite the heavy weight I bore. But at his understanding word, a candle's lifted spark flared warm and goldenly to light my way across the dark. Dear God, so vital was the word, I too would seek them out, who wander lonely through the night of fear and grief and doubt. Speak through me, Lord, that I may say the word to free and bless, a gentle word, a word to light the road to happiness. Thank you so much.